BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. And, for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is Sir Tim Waterstone. When he founded Waterstones back in 1982, his initial vision of a literary haven for book lovers, late opening shops bursting with stock and staffed by knowledgeable enthusiasts, was considered highly unconventional. Many, including his former employers at WH Smith, didn't think it would last. He proved them wrong, and his shops proved the perfect home for readers and writers alike. The stores also became the natural choice for launch parties and public appearances by the literary firebrands of the day. Browsing was actively encouraged and was good for business too. Over 70% of sales were impulse buys. His life as a bookseller might best be filed under adventure. He built Waterstones up, sold it to old rivals, bought it back, then quit, then helped someone else buy it. One constant has been his love of books themselves. He says, "I think the printed word on paper between two boards is the most fabulous consumer product. It's cheap, it's lovely, everyone adores it. It's collectible, storable, transportable. It's a beautiful product." Sir Tim Waterstone, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You no longer own Waterstones, but you always said that your target market was literary book browsers. Why is browsing such a particular pleasure?
Well, we both know that it is such a particular pleasure to go into a bookshop and read half a chapter and put it down. And we really encourage browsing because we know when people come in to browse, they're sooner or later going to buy, and sometimes much more than they first thought they were going to buy when they first walked into the shop. You know, you want people to be relaxed when they go into a bookshop and just thoroughly enjoy the whole process of looking at books, picking them up, putting them down again, browsing them.
Is it true that you sometimes pop into Waterstones to people watch?
I do. Particularly Piccadilly, the huge branch in Piccadilly, and it is a tremendous pleasure to go in there on a busy Saturday and I sit on a sofa there just watch people. It's so lovely to see people and see how well the staff interact with them and how happy people are in the bookshop. It's lovely.
The book-selling trade is ever-changing. Audiobooks are up, overall book sales are going down and Amazon continues to be a dominant player. What do you see as the role of independent booksellers today?
Well, before I do that, I'd say that Waterstones and Amazon completely dominate the market here now. And independent booksellers have to be very, very good to compete. And the ones that are very good compete easily. But independents can't survive if they don't run a proper width of stock, a proper depth of stock, and have people working in the stores who are not just enthusiasts, but really do know what they're talking about.
Your love and passion for music is evident in your list today. Tell me about your first choice. What is it and why have you selected it?
Well, my first choice is the Rachmaninoff Second Piano Concerto. And it's here for this reason, that I came from a totally unmusical family. I played the piano a little bit from the age of 7 or 8. And learning a little Mozart piece made me realise that classical music might be interesting. But we had no music in the house at all. We had a piano which was polished all the time to impress the neighbours and never played. But one day I walked into our village. I lived in Crowborough in Sussex. And I went into the music shop and browsed the records there. And then the lovely man who owned it said, "What are you looking for and how much money have you got?" "I haven't got any money whatsoever, so I wasn't going to buy anything." But he'd talked to me for a bit and heard that I played the piano. And he said, "Well, I tell you what I'll do. I'll give you a scratch record from the back of the shop. You needn't pay for it. And see how you like this piece. And if you like it, I'll give you another one like it." And what he gave me was the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto. Malcolm Sargent conducting the Liverpool Phil with Cyril Smith, the soloist. And I took it home and my mother was out and we did have a radiogram. And I put the LP on and opened up the French windows into the garden and sat on the steps and looked out into the garden. And then this music just burst out and I had absolute total revelation to me. I just couldn't believe I'd heard something so beautiful. And that got me hooked for life, you know, from Rachmaninoff to all through a whole journey for the next 70 years.
part of Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2, the first movement performed by the Liverpool Philharmonic with Cyril Smith as the soloist and conducted by Malcolm Sargent. Sir Tim Waterston, yours was a wartime childhood. Your father had enlisted in the Royal Army Service Corps, and after following his postings around the country, as you mentioned, you settled in Crowborough in East Sussex in 1942. What was life like there?
I found the war extremely exciting and fun, because that part of Sussex was where the fighter planes used to fight, you know, above us all the time, and I used to lie in the garden and watch the planes in the air. My poor older brother was terrified of it and hid under the piano, wouldn't come out. We had a Canadian soldier camp in the village, which was interesting, and they were great fun, and they added to the whole spice of the thing. But it was a shock when my father came home, because I was a baby when he went away to the war, and my mother told me he was coming home on leave, and I was 3 years old. And then I drew him some pictures to give him when he arrived. And then the day came and she called out, "Your father's here." And I went into the hall and there was this tall man in uniform looking down at me. And I held up the pictures for him and he took the pictures. And then I said something so absolutely dreadful that I probably changed the whole nature of my childhood. And I can picture my mother standing behind him, first smiling and then her face dropping, when I said to him, "Go away, go away. We're happy without you here. Go away." And he shrunk back. If he'd been a man of stronger character, he would have handled that. But he just couldn't handle it at all, so pushed me away. And we had a really awful relationship all through the childhood. And honestly, I think it dated from that dreadful thing I said to him in the hall.
Yeah. I mean, reading about your relationship, you said that sarcasm was his weapon of choice, and it's quite a chilling description, the weapon that no child can weather or combat.
Mm. Children can't do sarcasm. They don't understand it at all. Yeah, endless sarcasm. And shouted at me, persistent. To this day, I hate shouting. And he was a weak man. But my mother was very affectionate to me, and I think partly trying to offset, you know, what my father was doing. But she clearly thought her main duty in life was to protect him from the world. He just couldn't really cope with the world. And I used to think it didn't damage me at all. I think now it did damage me somewhat. I had a terrible stutter from the age of 6 to 13 or 14. I had to plan a sentence before I started it. And then I lost that suddenly when I went to secondary school, and confidence grew and stutter just disappeared. Extraordinary. It did damage me, but the extraordinary thing is it gave in me such a desire to prove him wrong in his disparagement of me that, you know, I'm absolutely certain that's what Waterstones came from in the end.
It's time for your second piece of music, Tim Waterstone. What's it going to be and why have you chosen it?
Well, I'm going to go through to one of my absolutely favourite pieces of music, Sibelius' Fifth Symphony, by my absolutely favourite conductor, Leonard Bernstein, conducting the Vienna Philharmonic, and we're going to hear the coda of it at the end. It is a piece made for Bernstein's conducting, very theatrical, very emotional, and he clearly absolutely loved the piece. It is a sensationally beautiful piece of work.
Part of the coda from Sibelius' Symphony No. 5, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Tim Waterstone, books would become your passion, but there weren't many in the house. Where and how did you feed your love of reading?
Yes, well, what happened was I think it was 1946 or 1947, just after the war, and I would have been either six or seven, a wonderful bookshop opened in the village called the Book Club, which is owned by a lady called Miss Santoro. And I remember peering through the window the day before it opened, thinking, this looks wonderful. And I really spent my childhood there. I was there every day reading. First of all, Miss Santoro actually taught me to read, and then, of course, she taught me what to read. I never bought a single book all those years. I never had any money to buy one.
What were you reading?
Well, she started me off with fairly standard, particularly as I found reading difficult technically, she started me off with fairly sort of standard children's books and then nursed me through to the humour books like Just William. And then we went into my sort of moody teenage years and we did Dostoevsky, we did George Eliot, and she was a great lover of Graham Greene. But she, it was also her insistence that I talk to her about the book. So it taught me a fantastic amount.
You described Miss Santoro as quite an imposing character.
Yes, she was horrid sometimes. Never to me. Well, once she was to me, when she caught me licking my finger before turning a page, she actually went for me in front of her. And every time I've done that since, I always remember Miss Santoro telling me off, an eight-year-old, wherever I was in the shop.
Your parents went to India with your father's job, which meant you were sent to boarding school at just six. I mean, reading about your experiences there, absolutely horrendous. You know, you describe being sexually abused by the head teacher, and that is an experience from which many survivors never fully recover. What was the impact on you?
Well, I discussed all this some years ago with a therapist, and I sincerely believe, I don't think I was damaged by it. I probably should have been. I was extremely ignorant, and I just thought this is what life must be like. You know? But when I first talked to people about this publicly, it was a few years ago when I did an interview with the Times Educational Supplement, and I talked about it then, and I did it so stupidly, or it didn't do me any harm, sort of nonsense, you know. And about a week later, I had a letter forwarded on to me from a reader who read the article, and she was furious with me. Her husband had been at that school after me and had been through the same experience, and said, how dare you talk about it like that, you know, it ruined my husband's life. He killed himself, and never, never do that again. You know, you may have come out of it, but most of those children will not have come out of it. So, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I had two things going with me at once. I had my father to deal with, and this, and it was the father thing which really, really got to me.
Let's go to the music. It's time for your third disc today.
I wanted Elgar, and I've gone to The Dream of Gerontius, performed by the Halle Orchestra with Janet Baker. Tell me about Janet Baker. She actually started as a contralto at the bottom, so she moved into being a mezzo in the middle. And it gives her voice, to me, an absolutely unique quality in the mezzo, a very velvety, slightly dark quality. She has the most gorgeous voice.
Of Elgar's The Dream of Gerontius, performed by the Halle Orchestra and chorus with Dame Janet Baker, conducted by John Barbaroli. Tim Waterston, life changed for the better when you moved on to Tonbridge School when you were 13. You were also captivated, I think, by Mrs. Austin's one-to-one English lessons. What were they like?
Yeah, she was wonderful. She asked me sort of questions that I hadn't been asked before. There's a D.H. Lawrence story called The Odour of Chrysanthemums, which she gave me to read. And then the following Tuesday, when I went to her or something, she said, tell me about the story. So I started off my normal account of what the story was. And then she said, no, darling, not that. What does the story mean? A light bulb went off my mind of what, you know, how fiction is about meaning something. It's not such a literal narrative arc, you know.
reading about you, talking about her, and also talking about the bookshop of your childhood, I was struck by the atmosphere of both those experiences. You know, the flowers in the jar on Mrs. Austen's table, books everywhere. And it struck me that actually that was what you went on to recreate in your shops.
Yes, it was. Yes, I mean, when I went to Cambridge, there was Heffer's, the university bookshop. I stood there one day and I knew what I wanted to do was to create a book-selling empire. I'm sorry I'm so being so immodest, which was sort of cross between the book club in Crowborough, the small independent, and Heffer's, the vast, great university bookshop. I just wanted to put them together in one package. And I didn't want one little bookshop, I wanted hundreds of them. So it was there, and it was something about Mrs. Austen, it was something about Miss Santora, and it was something about a research student who taught me at Cambridge, Francis Warner, who introduced me to a whole concept of books and culture and what they meant.
Let's hear your next disc. This is your fourth. Tell me why you've chosen it.
Well, I've chosen an anthem, or perhaps more accurately described as a carol. I was at a small college called St Catherine's, and next door was the Great King's, and I used to go quite often to evensong in the King's Chapel, which is one of the most glorious places in the world, to hear the choral music, absolutely sublime. And one day I heard this carol, Jesus Christ, the Apple Tree, composed by Elizabeth Poston, who worked in the BBC here for some time, and she was a composer and she was a teacher of music. It is a most beautiful, beautiful piece of music.
Jesus Christ the Apple Tree, composed by Elizabeth Poston, performed by the King's College Cambridge Choir, conducted by Sir David Wilcox. Tim Waterstone, after university, you worked for a broking firm in India and while there, married your first wife, Tricia. The marriage didn't last and afterwards you suffered a breakdown. What form did it take?
Well, let me say this. A breakdown of that sort is absolutely unmistakable. It's not just being depressed or, you know, moody or blue. Physically, I couldn't move. I literally couldn't move my hands without enormous effort and couldn't construct a sentence. And I just stopped, you know, it's as if your body, brain just stopped on you. But I was very anxious not to lose my job. So I tried to keep going as long as I could, but then they sent me off, you know, to get home and get well, which in those days was unbelievably, I mean, nobody behaved like that. It's brilliant. This is the middle 60s. But I eventually got myself to go to the dentist. I knew the dentist well. And he started getting worried about looking at me worried. And he put a hand on my shoulder and he talked to me again. And he went over to the phone. And then I'm trying to remember because I'm actually blur the memory of this. But they went to the phone and arranged me to be immediately taken. It was the Maudsley in South London, and the car took me down there, and they immediately admitted me. And I think they must have drugged me up, and I am hesitating, not meeting your eyes. I'm just trying to remember exactly what happened. I remember the dreadful day room, you know, which in those days was full of cigarette stubs and cigarette smells and furniture polish, you know, that sort of dreadful institutional smell, those sort of places. And then I think it's only fifth or sixth day or something like that. I mean, I just did feel better. But I asked to see the specialist again, and I said, look, I'd like to go home now, please, or I will take the pills. And he first of all said, well, you can't, because, you know, I can hold you here. But then he agreed. And he said, who's going to look after you at home? And I lied about that, because I was on my own. And he said, I must tell you, you will be back. Don't be fearful of it. It will happen. Well, I absolutely never did. 2 weeks later or so, I threw the drugs away. I felt fine, and it was the most extraordinary thing. It's never come back. Never come back.
You and Tricia had three children together, and you had three more children with your second wife, Claire. Yeah. Given your experience with your father, how did you find parenthood?
I find it the most blissful experience you could possibly imagine. And I came to the conclusion early on that all you can do with children is love them and give them confidence and then, you know, let them go. But, you know, I didn't give any of them a very secure childhood. But they all know that I love them dearly and still do.
Let's go to the music. Tell us about your next piece.
Well, the next piece of music is the Mahler Symphony No. 5 in C-sharp minor, the Adagio. The reason I've chosen that is that in 1990, I became director and a trustee of the London Philharmonic Orchestra, which gave me seven incredibly happy years with the orchestra, and I learned so much from them. There had been a concert at Christmas time in 1988, before I actually became involved with the London Philharmonic, when the London Philharmonic was playing a wonderful concert that was led by the Mahler Symphony No. 5, conducted by Klaus Tennstedt. Now, Klaus Tennstedt was a legendary conductor in those days, and he was a terrifyingly frail man, furious temper too. And I used to go to some of the rehearsals with him, watching him rehearse the London Philharmonic, sometimes furious, sometimes very loving towards them. It made me realise what a great conductor can do. Well, I was there that night, and it was only years later that I found that it was actually a night where they'd recorded the orchestra live. So we're going to hear it. Klaus Tennstedt and London Philharmonic was an absolutely magical combination. Put Mahler in front of them and you've got something absolutely, totally divine.
Part of Mahler's Symphony No. 5, the Adagietto, performed by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Klaus Tennstedt. Tim Waterstone, in 1973, you went to work for W.H. Smith, and there you learned a great deal about the book business. But in 1981, you were sacked and left with a redundancy payment of £6,000. What do you remember about your thoughts as you left that day?
Oh, it was happiest moment of my life, really. I hated working there, and I'd always wanted to do Waterstones, and here at last I knew somebody had made the decision for me and fired me.
But on that day, weren't you scared?
No, I was angry, actually. A mixture of anger and excitement. I wasn't scared at all. Not at all. I should have been. I mean, I was responsible for all these kids, you know. I was absolutely exhilarated. I just had to do it. I knew it would work. The moment I started recruiting staff, and they're all young, they're all arts graduates straight down from uni, the moment I described to them the detail of what I wanted to do, all four said, it'll work. So it became everybody's plan, and all got caught up in the excitement of it. It was great, it really was.
Waterstones was born in 1982. What was your original vision as you set it out to those staff that you converted?
Well, it was this, a very heavy stock. So the place was going to be packed with books, sold by people who love selling books and already knew about books. Could hold a wonderful conversation with anybody who wanted to talk to them. This is Miss Santoro, of course, going to be out again. Trading very long hours, evenings, Sundays. I mean, trading on Sundays was illegal in those days. We just simply went ahead and did it, and we got away with it. And what I impressed on everybody is we're going to open branch after branch after branch as quickly as we could. And I wanted them to feel that there was no head office. In fact, the head office in those days only consisted of three people anyway, which was me and two others. Yeah, actually, the head office we had for the first 2 years was only a room smaller than this, 12 foot by 6 foot, with a lavatory off it. And we only had room for two chairs. So if the three of us are there, one of them had to sit on the loo while the other two had the chairs. So everything was pushed into the branches. We didn't want to waste a penny at the centre. And it was a wonderful time to do it, the 80s, because, A, nobody else was doing this, and secondly, there's a wonderful thrust of new authors coming through at that time.
Who do you
remember? Well, Salman Rushdie, William Boyd, Jeanette Winterson, you know, Peter Ackroyd, A.S. Byer, Margaret Drabble, Ishiguro, you know, they're all coming through at the same time. And there were no literary festivals in those days, apart from Cheltenham and Hay. The branches we opened throughout the country were the literary festivals. And authors were in every night, signing, talking to the customers. And gosh, it was fun. It really was fantastically good fun.
It's time for your next disc. Why have you chosen this?
Well, this is the Goldmark Violin Concerto, number one. The story behind this was this early 90s. And it was a period of immense personal happiness in my life. I'd met Rosie and we'd married and I was so, so happy. And I must, I think, have been visiting the old Brompton Road shop, which is by now one of 100, you know, because when I went back to the tube station, there was a little music shop which sold only classical music. And I walked in and they were playing something which was absolutely beautiful and I didn't recognise it. I just stood there absolutely transfixed with the beauty of this. And I bought the record and played it and played it and played it. And since then, it's become one of my absolutely favourite movements.
Part of Carl Goldmark's Violin Concerto No. 1, the Andante, performed by Itzhak Perlman and the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andre Previn. Tim Waterstone, as your business expanded, you became notable for your aggressive tactics. You were often challenging established bookshops. Sometimes you'd open up near a lone independent and the result would be that they would go out of business. Apparently, Alan Bennett never quite forgave you for what happened in Leeds.
No, that's true. But we went to Leeds and there was a rather famous bookseller there. Been there for many decades. I mean, it had no energy, no drive at all. But it was Alan Bennett's favourite bookshop. Perhaps we would have hesitated if we'd known that at the time. Anyway, we just opened pretty well next door and they closed down within about 3 weeks.
But as you grew and sometimes other businesses and competitors did close, did you ever feel guilty?
Do you know, I have to say no, I wasn't. I didn't feel guilty. I just felt that they'd had the shot. You know, there's a lot of things people used to say to me about me personally, that I was personally responsible for closing down far too many independent bookshops. But the truth of it is that Waterstones, when it started, was the smallest independent bookseller you could possibly imagine. £6,000 from me, a lot of debt. I mean, we had nothing. But what we did have was self-confidence and a very clear offer and wonderful staff and a wonderful business model. And we weren't sympathetic, quite honestly.
You've written, success is not the making of a fortune, but the making of a point. Who are you proving yourself to?
Me, but of course my father, yeah. And a bit to the world too, you know. I mean, it doesn't sound as we'd invented anything very original, but we had, actually. And my father was underlying it. And my sister was a brilliant sister to me, much, much older than me. She sort of mothered me, rather. I mean, she was always completely on my side. A little bit of it was showing her.
Your father didn't live to see your success, but your sister did. What did she make of it?
Well, she was, first of all, rather pleased because she was a shareholder. She did rather well financially out of it. She was very proud.
Waterstones was independent for 11 years. You sold the company to W.H. Smith in 1993. It can be complicated letting go of something with your name on it. I mean, it was your baby. even though you felt like it was the right time? You must have had a certain amount of mixed feelings.
It was painful. But on the other hand, I told myself not to feel like that. I was in young 50s. I thought, to hell with it. There's other things I can do in my life, and it's been great. And I was convinced by the Smith letter, which they did absolutely honour, about the staggering amount of investment they were going to put into it. You know, it felt the right thing to do, and it was the right thing to do.
Let's go to the music. This is your seventh today. Why have you chosen this?
Well, most of my adult life has been in London, and I do love London very, very dearly. And I suddenly remember that lovely song a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. And I had heard years ago the wonderful John the Measurer sort of talking his way through the song, and so absolutely delightfully. I thought, what would be nice of me is I dream of London gazing out into the lovely sea around me on the desert island, and to hear John the Measurer's voice as well. So very English and so lovely.
The streets of town were paved with stars. It was such a romantic affair. And as we kissed and said goodnight, a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square.
John the Measurer with "A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square." Sir Tim Waterstone, you found lasting happiness with your wife, Rosie, whom you met in 1988. Now, apparently, you knew straight away that this was it, but she took a little bit longer to come round.
Not so long.
What happened?
Well, I should say immediately there's 25 years age difference between us. I mean, me is 49, she was 24. She'd just finished at Oxford, and we were interviewing people, and she walked into my office. She's carrying some shopping bags. It's such an unusual entrance. And it was an absolute immediate, total coup de foudre for me. And I just absolutely felt overwhelmingly in love with her. And we were together for 2 years, and then we married. And two more delicious daughters appeared in short order. And it was just lovely.
You're 80 now and have just written a memoir. What has looking back on your life taught you?
I think it's taught me that I'm an incredibly lucky man, actually. Obviously, there are parts of my private life which have been catastrophic, but I feel very, very blessed. And what it's taught me, I think, is to follow your star. I hated corporate life. I came out of corporate life and created my own corporation. Be yourself. It's when you're not being yourself you're most uncomfortable. Love. That's what I learned. Love.
It's time for your last disc. Tell me about this one.
La Mer, Charles Trenet. So suitable for desert islands. One of the very, very early lessons in Zen Buddhism is you should stand before a crystal blue sea, staring out at the horizon as a moon's calming yourself. So that's what I'm going to be doing, looking out at the crystal blue sea.
Voyez, ces oiseaux blancs et ces maisons rouillées. La mer les a bercées le long des golfes clairs et d'une chanson d'amour. La mer a bercé mon cœur pour la vie. La mer.
Charles Trenet and La Mer. Sir Tim Waterstone, I'm about to cast you away, of course. You're going to be in complete isolation, apart from your books and music. How do you feel about the prospect?
I'm actually quite good on my own. As you pointed out earlier, I am 80. There's all sorts of things I like to do about thinking. There's no way I'm going to try to escape, incidentally. I don't swim well enough, one thing. And secondly, I'd be completely incapable of constructing a raft which would get me beyond the first 5 feet of water. Mm.
So the books, I give you the complete works of Shakespeare and the Bible to take with you. You can also take a book of your own choice, just one, I'm afraid. What will yours be?
Well, I did think about that. I thought, first of all, Tolstoy. But then I changed my mind because something I do love doing is memorising poetry. So I've chosen, actually, the Oxford Book of English first, because then I can read lots of poetry which I already know and love and learn a lot of it. So that's it. I can be very happy, actually, Bible, Shakespeare.
You can also have a luxury item.
Yes, there is something which I would like there more than anything else. There is a photo of Rosie taken way back when we were very first together, and she's not realising the photograph's being taken. It's in somebody's garden. And I carry that photograph with me everywhere, and I'd like that to survive the shipwreck.
It's yours. I also have to ask, if you could save just one of these tracks from the waves, which would it be?
Well, I think it better be Gerontius. I could listen to that 100 times and find more and more beauty in it. So, Gerontius, Elgar, Janet Baker, please.
Sir Tim Waterstone, thank you very much for sharing your Desert Island Discs with us.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Tim, and I wish him all the very best as he whiles away the many hours on the island learning poems by heart, contemplating the waves, and that photograph of Rosie, his wife. I think Tim would be impressed by the wonderfully diverse range of writers, nearly all of whom have been as keen on reading as he is, in our Desert Island Discs back catalogue. You can enjoy listening to Maya Angelou, Alan Bennett, Zadie Smith, V.S. Naipaul, Faye Weldon, Diana Atill. It's a huge list, and there's a novelist there to suit every taste. You can find them all on BBC Sounds or on the Desert Island Discs website. Back in 2007, Kirsty cast away Edna O'Brien.
You moved to London once you'd been married for a few years with your two young boys and your husband, and you wrote The Country Girls.
Yes, The Country Girls remains in my personal life, my little, what shall we call it, hold-all of experiences. A little miracle for me. Up to then, I had been writing scattered bits and pieces, and suddenly I sat down and I began. I wakened quickly and sat up in bed abruptly. It is only when I am anxious that I waken easily, and for a minute I could not remember the old reason, my father, he had not come home. And I knew that I was there. I could write it. I have to tell you, they don't come as easily now. But that was like, it was like a lucid trance, if you know what I mean. And it was finished. In 3 weeks.
Those 3 weeks profoundly changed your life. This book was brilliantly received. I mean, your talent was there for all to behold. And at the same time, it was being burned on the streets of Ireland. How did you hear of that?
There was no shortage of hearing it. My mother conveyed to me, you know how people do, they want to tell you something, and they will say, somebody else said, you know, and somebody else said to your father, I should be kicked naked through the town. And I didn't question her. This will show you what a coward I am. I should have questioned the naked, but I didn't. Charles Haughey, who was then Minister for Culture, and the Archbishop McQuaid, saying it should not be in the hands of any decent family, and it was a smear on Irish womanhood, and people, you know, cutting me and sending me anonymous letters and all that.
Did it matter to you that your homeland was appalled?
Yeah. Oh, it hurt me very much, because deep down, you have a question with yourself. You feel, have I betrayed them? Have I done something wrong, as they have said I have? And being a little prone to that kind of self-examination, I was defiant or semi-defiant on the outside, but I was also made very nervous.
Edna O'Brien talking to Kirsty in 2007. Next week, my guest will be the businesswoman Josephine Fairley. Do join us.
Hello, I'm John Ronson, the author of So You've Been Publicly Shamed. This is my journey into the lives of the shamed, people ruined by a badly worded tweet or work faux pas. Along the way, I turned from being a keen shamer myself into somebody unsettled by this new zeal to judge and condemn, often on very weak evidence. That's So You've Been Publicly Shamed, read by me, John Ronson, and abridged specially for BBC Sounds.